Millions of Americans are saddled with student loan debt. Debts in the tens of thousands of dollars make it difficult to focus on something like saving for retirement. Later this hour, we talk about how some employers in Illinois are trying to ease that burden by helping young people save for retirement so they can focus on paying down that student debt. Plus, the Illinois Office of Tourism has announced a new crop of artisans, farmers, and businesses from around the state to join its Illinois Made program. We talked to a few of them about their unique goods and the challenges of getting people to eat and shop locally. But first, it's hard to compete in elections if you're not a Democrat or a Republican. Third parties often get sidelined, whether it's because of ballot access or getting into televised debates. Here's U of I professor Brian Gaines.
I always chuckle when we call them third parties. It's as though we count 1, 2, 3, 3, 3, 3. Every party that isn't a Republican or Democrat gets designated third.
That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up on today's show, many of us have struggled with student debt or know people who have. In fact, it's so common that some companies are starting to offer assistance as a way to attract young talent to work for them. Plus, if you like to shop local all over the state, the Department of Tourism has collected a new trove of hidden gems, perhaps in your neighborhood. We'll speak with a few local businesses in the Illinois Made series. But first, the midterm elections are less than 4 months away. Voters will choose their state and local officials, including members of Congress and, of course, our next governor. And when you go to fill out your ballot here in Illinois, you'll see at least four names, party-affiliated names, in the race for governor. You probably know about two of them, our current Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and the Democratic nominee, billionaire J.B. Pritzker. But this time, there are two more candidates on the ballot. One of them is the Libertarian Party's nominee, Cash Jackson, and the other is current Republican State Senator Sam McCann, running under the banner of the Conservative Party. Third-party candidates can have a hard time attracting voters when compared to the two dominant parties in the U.S., and Illinois doesn't make it any easier. With me on the line to talk about this is Rich Whitney. He was the Green Party's nominee for governor of Illinois in 2006 and 2010. Brian Gaines is also in our studio at WILL. He's a professor of political science with the Institute for Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
Good morning.
Brian, before we even get to the big race for governor, I'd like to ask you about what it takes to even get on the ballot in the first place, if you're not a Democrat or a Republican. Folks may remember that members of the two major parties voted for their nominees back in March to decide who would represent them in the general election. How is it different for other parties?
Well, everybody has to collect signatures to get a ballot spot in Illinois, and that's pretty typical, though not true of all of the American states. One of the ways that Illinois is particularly unfriendly to minor parties, and I always chuckle when we call them third parties, it's as though we count 1, 2, 3, 3, 3, 3. I mean, every party that isn't a Republican or Democrat gets designated third. But the minor parties have to collect more signatures. Independents also have to collect more. And it's hard to offer a good normative justification for why you should make it harder to get onto the ballot if you're not one of the two parties that happens to suck up most of the votes. But Illinois is not alone in that, but the threshold is higher here. So I think we're probably one of the 10 least friendly states to parties other than the major two, Republican and Democratic.
Rich Whitney, you ran as a third or fourth or fifth party candidate for governor in 2006. You won 10% of the vote that year. That's, on the one hand, not the percentage you ultimately want because the idea is to win, but it was also pretty substantial for a third-party candidate. What do you remember from the days of trying to get on the ballot for the first time?
Oh, it is a tremendous difficulty. We have to, for statewide races, we have to get officially 25,000 petition signatures from registered voters, which is five times the number that legally it's called the established parties have to get in running for the primary. So there's that. But the other thing that makes it extraordinarily difficult, and Brian is quite correct about that, we're one of the worst states in this regard, is it also has to be done in a 90-day window. You know, you cannot start until a certain date after the primary. It's generally from late March to late June, but it's a 90-day window, which makes it extraordinarily difficult. And I might add, it's getting more difficult as time goes on because the opportunities for collecting these signatures are kind of vanishing. You know, there are only so many events, fairs, carnivals, things like that, where a person actually has access to approach voters and try to collect their signature. The other way to do it is get it going door to door, but that's a very laborious process, you know, trying to find registered voters at home at the time that you happen to be knocking on their door trying to get their signature.
Brian, I wonder, you know, in terms of getting onto the ballot in Illinois, how, I mean, you talked about how it compares to other states. You said we're one of the hardest. Are there states that make it pretty easy to do that?
Oh, there are. If you look at election returns after any general election and just sort of sweep across them, you'll notice there are a lot of candidates in select states, Michigan and New Jersey, California, Vermont. And then you'll just see the D's and R's in a lot of other states. And in some states, the states that make it even harder than Illinois put requirements on fielding a full slate of candidates, that you're not an established or, you know, whatever the legal terminology in the given state is, and not an established party unless you have candidates running for some pretty high threshold of all of the offices in a county or in a in the state, statewide.
So not just governor, but lieutenant governor, attorney general, you know, the
yeah, that kind of
so-called
requirement.
dog catcher, that sort of thing.
You can't have a party that doesn't have, that has a candidate just for the one office. But in other states, it's pretty much the same requirement for anybody to get on the ballot. You have to show some level of support, some minimal level. Rich mentions the windows. There isn't always a front end on the window. There has to be a back end. You have to have your signatures well in advance of printing of ballots. But other states will let you collect, start well, you know, much earlier, so that it's not really nearly so onerous. So, you know, again, I think if you just sort of glance at how why is it that there's so much support for other parties in, say, Vermont or Michigan? And, you know, it isn't that they're winning lots of seats, but there are a handful of seats won by candidates other than Republicans or Democrats. It's partly because it's not such a chore to even to mount a campaign in the first place to get onto the ballot.
Rich, as we've talked about, and as you know, a big challenge for third parties is to simply get their names out there in front of more people. And one of the ways to do that is to be in a televised debate. And as we're seeing now, Senator McCann and Cash Jackson are pushing to get into debates with Governor Rauner and J.B. Pritzker. Rich, when you were running for governor, was that important to you as well?
Oh, absolutely. That was a huge issue. You know, we fought very hard. And matter of fact, we had when there were some of the debates between Rod Blagojevich and Judy Bar Topinka, and then later on the ones, you know, with Pat Quinn
Bill Brady.
Bill Brady. Thank you. We actually, you know, ended up having protests. We tried to file a complaint. We did file a complaint with the FCC about our exclusion from some of the debates. The only debate that I was allowed to be included in was we did have one at WSIU in Southern Illinois, where I was able to share the stage with Quinn and Brady. And unfortunately, you know, not enough people saw that one, except in Southern Illinois. So that you know, had a significant effect.
So you got into one debate out of two elections? Is that?
That's correct. We were excluded from all the others. And this is very common. I might mention that currently the Green Party and the Libertarian Party are still involved in a lawsuit challenging the Commission on Debates for presidential debates, because, of course, we've seen that as well, where even we do the hard work to get on the ballot in like 45 states, we're still excluded, you know, and theoretically, you know, could get enough votes from the college. We are still excluded from the national debates as well.
We're talking to Rich Whitney. He was a Green Party candidate for Illinois governor in 2006 and 2010, and also Brian Gaines from the University of Illinois. Rich, in 2010, your share of the vote, as we said, was 10%, and you did something that I think defies the conventional wisdom about third-party candidates. That wisdom is so conventional, it made its way into pop culture. I'm thinking of that Simpsons episode from the 90s where a pair of space aliens take over the bodies of Bill Clinton and Bob Dole.
America, take a good look at your beloved candidates. They're nothing but hideous space reptiles. It's true. We are aliens. But what are you going to do about it? It's a two-party system. You have to vote for one of us.
He's right. This is a two-party system.
Well, I believe I'll vote for a third-party candidate.
Go ahead. Throw your vote away.
So in 2006 in Illinois, like we said, Rich Whitney, you got 10% of the vote, and it was not throwing a vote away, at least if you're a liberal voter who, you know, might be worried about spoiling for the Democrats. I guess my serious question to you, Rich, is what did your showing in 2006 do for the Green Party?
Well, and by the way, that was my favorite Simpsons episode. That was great. Thanks for playing that. The effect is that any party that gets over 5% of the vote, whether statewide or in a particular jurisdiction, thereby becomes an established party like the Democrats and Republicans. So after 2006, we were able to take advantage of a much lower ballot access threshold throughout the state. And so we're able to run a lot more candidates in 2008 and 2010. And so, you know, it did help us get established. Unfortunately, conditions were not as favorable in 2010, and we fell below the 5% threshold in that election. And so we lost it statewide, although we did manage to preserve it in certain jurisdictions scattered throughout the state.
Well, that actually leads into my next question, which is, where is the Green Party today compared to, in Illinois at least, compared to where it was 10 or 12 years ago?
Well, I think it's fair to say it's the equivalent of two steps forward, one step back. I mean, we're definitely better off than we were in 2004, or, you know, or 2005 before the 2006 election, but we're not as in as good a position as we were during that period between 2006 and 2010. We faced, you know, there's been some, we believe that there's actually been some gerrymandering in some places after the 2010 census, where there were some spots where we had over 5% of the vote, but then because the district contours were changed, there were some court rulings that said, well, now it's a different district, so we rule you didn't have over 5%, so you have to start from scratch again. So we faced that problem. But despite that, in some respects, we are better off. We have elected some people to local office. We have some people serving on city councils, park boards, library district boards, et cetera. So, you know, there has been incremental progress.
So, Brian Gaines, let's turn to this election, 2018. We're seeing at least two minor party candidates, Senator Sam McCann and Cass Jackson. Where do you see their respective voters coming from as far as political views are concerned?
Yeah, the conventional wisdom would be they're both a threat to Bruce Rauner, the incumbent. The libertarian vote is not necessarily strictly Republican. The more conservative voters, libertarians tend to have a host of views. They sometimes agree with Democrats, sometimes Republicans, sometimes they dislike the positions of both the major parties intensely. But if you just go across time on average, libertarians tend to be a little bit more favorable to Republicans. Greens tend to be a little bit more favorable to Democrats. So the major parties tend to regard them as usurpers who are stealing votes, libertarians from Republicans and Greens from Democrats. The Sam McCann candidacy is different. He's running as a conservative, but Illinois doesn't really have a conservative party as such. This is really an operation of one man, and it's he is an elected Republican, so again, his base of support is within his own district is Republicans, and I think his outreach is pretty clearly continuing the primary campaign, which almost but didn't quite oust Bruce Rauner, and people on the right of the party who are unhappy with him, primarily over social issues. So you'd have to start out thinking that if people who cast votes for those two candidates who might still have voted in their absence would break in favor of Rauner rather than Pritzker.
Hmm. Rich, I know you're probably not, I'm guessing you're not pulling for either the conservative or libertarian parties in the governor's race, but would you have any advice for them as they're trying to mount their campaigns from outside against the two major parties?
Well, you know, I wish I had a magic answer for, you know, how you crack the two-party ceiling. It is obviously very challenging. We were able to take advantage of kind of a perfect storm in 2006, which we did not have in 2010. So, you know, the only thing we kind of hope for is that really there has to be a sea change in the thinking of the electorate is what it really amounts to. That, you know, we know that there's mass dissatisfaction with the two-party system. You know, poll after poll shows, you know, 60-70%, et cetera, saying, yeah, we really need a third party, you know, to represent us. But unfortunately, that, for whatever reason, that never seems to, or I shouldn't say never, but it rarely seems to translate into a lot of mass support at the polls. Unfortunately, when you actually get to election day, too many voters tend to fall back to the habits and you know, the thinking, well, you know, like the Simpsons episode, I don't want to throw my vote away.
Sure. And well, can I just, we're running out of time.
You know,
I'm sorry, we're running out of time, but can I just ask, who are, do you know who you're voting for yet?
I really do not. I probably, if it comes down to it, I'm thinking of maybe voting, at least maybe not the governor's race, but for some libertarians, because even though we disagree with the Libertarian Party in a lot of things, if the Libertarian Party were to get established, they would fight, I think, for better ballot access laws, for things like instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting, which would also help minority parties if adopted, like was recently adopted in Maine. So I may cast a protest vote for the Libertarian, even though I don't agree necessarily with the Libertarian Party and a lot of their economic policies in particular.
Rich Whitney was the Green Party candidate for governor of Illinois in 2006 and 2010. Brian Gaines is professor of political science with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Both of you, thanks so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. As the use of student loans increase, so does the awareness of the ramifications of high debt for young Americans. There's bad credit and even stress and poor health, according to some studies. And of course, one of the biggest problems is an inability to save. In Illinois, more than 60% of students who graduate college in our state have some amount of debt, with an average bill of almost $30,000. Now, some employers in Illinois are trying to ease that burden by helping young employees save for retirement so that they can focus on paying down their student loan debt. On the line with me now is Mary Moreland. Mary is the Divisional Vice President of Compensation and Benefits for Abbott Laboratories, one of the companies who's helping students save. We're also joined by Paige Jones, who is a communications specialist at Abbott. Paige got her master's degree from Northwestern University back in 2016. Mary, Paige, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi. Mary, can you tell us more about Abbott's Freedom to Save program? When did it begin? How does it work?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This program really grew out of a project we embarked upon a couple of years ago. We were challenging ourselves to extend our culture of innovation beyond just our products and really think about that innovation in terms of how we develop benefits and development opportunities for our people. Obviously, we want to attract the and retain the best in our industry. So we went out and said, what are the greatest needs for our employees? Are we addressing all of those needs? And if we aren't, how can we address those in an innovative way? Now, we know that for a typical 2017 college graduate, they have about $40,000 in debt, and federal statistics say that the average borrower between 20 and 30 owes $350 a month to service their student loans. So that means there's with all those payments, there's not a lot left over for traditional retirement plans. And in fact, in our research, we found that about two-thirds of millennials don't have anything saved for retirement. We compete for the best and the brightest in engineering, in science, in sales, in business development. Last year, we hired about 1,000 people under the age of 35 in the U.S., and the vast majority of them had a college degree. And more than a third of those had either a doctorate, and another third had a master's. So we know that even for our employees who are compensated well, student loans were a real burden and would be keeping them from setting aside the money they needed for retirement or just adding more stress by trying to pay down those student loans while also saving for retirement. So we took all of that together and said we wanted to help them start saving sooner. We know that for every decade that you wait to start saving, you have to save about twice as much for retirement. So we came up with this program to help them save while they pay down their student loans.
And what is, from the employer standpoint, right? So I understand, you want to recruit the best, but, I mean, we're talking this for these young people, their retirements are not going to be coming up for decades. They may not even be at Abbott at that point. What is the incentive from your standpoint?
We truly wanting to attract and retain the best and the brightest, but we also approach much of what we do with a long-term view, including mm-hmm. the people that we invest in. We know people are our biggest asset, and when we invest in them in programs such as this, we get that investment back to us in spades with productivity and retention and loyalty.
Sure.
We also think this really gives us a competitive edge in recruiting because we're not sure that there's any other company in the country right now with a program like this.
Okay. Paige, I want to bring you into the conversation. Paige Jones, as we heard at the top of the show, you're a graduate of Northwestern University, where you earned both bachelor's and master's degrees. You're one of an estimated 44 million Americans who left college with student loan debt. If it's not too personal, about how much debt did you have when you left Northwestern?
Hi. I think I'd be comfortable saying that I have a pretty considerable amount of debt from my graduate school education. It's definitely an amount that plays into how I budget myself monthly. In addition to that, it definitely had an effect on how I chose to budget that money. So what type of car I was able to purchase, what type of apartment I was able to live in, and in addition to that, how much I was able to invest in my 401k and other things of that nature.
I wonder, what did the debt, I mean, what does that amount of debt mean to you? I mean, was it a consideration in your job search? Were you looking for an employer who had a program like Freedom to Save?
So I actually didn't know that companies offered programs like this, and I think that that's pretty common amongst my friends and my peers. I'm not sure if a ton of students coming out of college even are aware to ask questions about programs like these. So it was not something that I was looking at when I was applying to jobs and trying to find something, but it is really comforting and really supportive to know that Abbott is pioneering a program like this in the way that they're doing it. And I would definitely advise students who are 22 or 21 and are graduating to look for companies that offer programs like these and to educate yourself in programs like these.
If you're comfortable saying, what percentage of your salary were you paying towards your student loans before this program came along?
Yeah, it's about 5% of my monthly salary.
Mm, wow. Okay. Mary, I want to turn back to you. Have you noticed that you said that Abbott's the first? Have you heard of any other companies even exploring this possibility? Is this something that one industry might do more than another?
After our announcement, which was a few weeks ago now, we've gotten a lot of interest from other employers who want to understand exactly how the program works. So I expect that others will be hopefully following suit. But at this point, I don't know of anyone who's doing it in this way.
What would you say to another company that might be worried about taking on a program like this, spending money on something like this?
I think it's all about what your company believes in, right? We believe that helping our employees to create a secure future for themselves and their families is really important. And we do that through programs like this. We actually have another program called Freedom to Work, which is an innovative phased retirement program. So for employees, let's say at the other end of the spectrum. But we really believe that investing in our employees is an important part of what we do as an employer, particularly to help them have the appropriate level of security for themselves and their families.
Paige, I want to ask you, before this program, were you thinking about saving for retirement? Is that something like you felt like you could do or even, you know, gave much consideration to?
Yeah, it was something that I gave consideration to. I was contributing to the 401k program here at Abbott beforehand. And now with this program being in place, I'll be able to take that money that I was contributing and be able to allocate that towards paying down my student loans faster, which is something that for me really helps with financial stress. I think all of us can relate to, we all want to pay down those loans as fast as we can and try to get rid of that debt as quickly as we can. So any amount of money that I can take from other parts of my financial budgeting and be able to allocate that towards paying down my debts is a huge stress reliever for me.
Yeah. I did want to ask Mary, it sounds like Paige is sort of in the minority here of, because there's what, 2/3 of Americans I've read age 21 to 32 have nothing saved for retirement. And that, I think that stats from the National Institute on Retirement Security. How important are these years of saving for young employees?
The getting started early is so critical. If you we know from our analysis that for every decade that you forego retirement savings, you have to save twice as much for the remainder of your career in order to get to the same level of retirement security. And so those early years, particularly with the beauty of compound interest, are really, really critical, and that's what we're hoping that this program will help to illustrate to our employees. If we take the example, say, an engineer right out of school who comes to work for us and takes advantage of this program, maybe making, let's say, $70,000 a year, over that first 10 years, if they participate in the program, they'll have over $50,000. So they're fresh out of school, maybe in their early 30s. They've already got $50,000 saved for retirement. By the time they actually do retire, that will be hundreds of thousands of dollars that they wouldn't have had if they hadn't gotten started that early.
We're talking about student debt and one possible way to help recent grads here on the 21st. I want to bring Mike Furmand into the conversation. Mike is the Assistant Director for Employer Outreach for the Graduate College at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You work with grad students at the U of I. Mike, what would you say some of those students are looking for in employers when they go into the job market?
Yeah, so, you know, students look at a lot of different factors. I think the most frequent things that come up in our conversations and our observations include, you know, the ability to make a real meaningful contribution to the organization, and then looking at how that contribution ties into the larger impact to the community and the society as a whole. You know, additionally, in graduate school, students develop a lot of different skills, so they're looking for new challenges and new opportunities to grow and use those skills. So that's another big item in the job search. But I think most importantly and probably most frequently is we hear that work-life balance piece. You know, the freedom to explore those different interests and curiosities that don't just go away after graduation. Mm-hmm. So that's something that is probably the most frequent thing that comes up in our conversations with students.
Do you hear a lot about, I mean, are students talking about retirement savings at that phase of their job search?
You know, every case is different. It's certainly something that comes up. I think often when a job offer comes in, you know, the salary and the monetary benefits are that big headline, you know, the first thing that they want to think about and talk about. But, you know, I know in our conversations with students, particularly when it comes to evaluating that job offers, looking at the whole package, you know, whether that's whatever monetary benefits beyond salary are included, but also, you know, will that allow them to be successful in the position, but also, you know, live a meaningful life outside of that as well.
Yeah, I wonder, how much is student loan debt a topic of conversation when you're talking to grad students? I mean, what are they telling you? What are they nervous about?
So, yeah, the specific issue of student debt is not something that really comes up or something that I'm really in a position to speak about. Hmm. But as it comes to, you know, kind of the entire financial package, students really want that stability and that security. And I think in hearing about the program from Abbott, you know, that's something that sounds really innovative, something I've never heard of, that would free up a student to not have to make those difficult choices, you know, once they're working with their finances, and gives them that stability and security to you know, not stress out as much when it comes to making those decisions.
Paige, I want to ask you, I wonder, are student loans something you talk about with your peers? I know money can be sometimes a touchy subject with people.
Yeah, it definitely is, especially I was fortunate enough to be able to attend graduate school with a classmate of mine, one of my really good friends, as well as my twin sister. We were all in grad school at Northwestern at the same time, and all of us kind of had different situations and whatnot, but it is something that we talk about, not all the time, but every now and then it pops up just with regular life, moving apartments, kind of the same topics I talked about before, just some of those regular life things that you don't always think about, but buying a car, paying insurance, paying your rent, where you live, how much you pay to commute to work, just random things like those. And we do talk about loans and kind of the burden that we feel from them. But like I said before, it is really nice to be able to know that I work at a company that is supportive and is trying to help all their employees and support them in that long term.
Yeah, I Mike, do you think from talking to students about these benefit packages, is something like this Freedom to Save program something that would help attract a student to go to a company?
Yeah, I think it's something that would definitely all students would look at as a major consideration. I think a big part of it would be the messaging, you know, that the company puts out there, because I do agree that, you know, often, whether it's not thinking about retirement or, you know, focusing on singular aspect of the salary, that, you know, students might miss the larger package of benefits that come in the job offer.
Mary, I wonder, based, you know, you meet with, I imagine, a lot of young people looking to work at your company. Is student debt something that comes up in your conversations, Mary? Is it a bigger issue now than when you first graduated?
Oh, it's certainly a bigger issue now than when I first was coming out of school. I think we hear about it a lot in the media now. We certainly hear about it from our own employees. Even since we've introduced this program, I've heard from a lot of our employees in a similar situation to Paige. They are currently saving for retirement, but they're struggling to, you know, do that along with paying off their student debt and doing all the other things they want to do. And this program has created a way to really help ease that burden, which is exactly what we had hoped. And we certainly hope that those students who are looking to join Abbott for a career will also have that same ability to take advantage of this program.
Hmm. Well, we've got just about a minute left. Paige, I wonder, how has this program affected you so far? I mean, obviously you're not at retirement age yet, but does it change the way you think about money, think about your employer?
Yeah, it definitely has. I remember telling my parents about this, and both my parents were really, really excited to hear that Abbott was creating and really pioneering a program like this. And it definitely has lifted, I can say, a big piece of stress off of my life. I know that, you know, we try to not think about money, and money isn't everything, but it is a reality of life. And paying bills is not glamorous. And I think, like Mike said earlier, you know, a lot of times when you're applying for jobs and you're looking for a good position, you kind of think of that salary number. But it's nice to know that programs like these do exist, especially one like what we have at Abbott. And it has lifted a nice piece of stress off of my life. And it's nice to know that I'll be able to pay those loans down a little bit quicker than I would be before.
That's Paige Jones. She's a Northwestern graduate and a communications specialist at Abbott Labs, and she joined us to talk about the student loan debt and saving for retirement. We also spoke with Mary Moreland, who's the Divisional Vice President of Compensation and Benefits for Abbott, and Mike Furman, who's the Assistant Director for Employer Outreach at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Paige, Mary, Mike, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to buying locally, the Illinois Office of Tourism is trying to make things a little easier for you. They've just added more than two dozen artisans, farms, bakeries, and other small businesses to their Illinois Made program. The idea is to help people in Illinois and tourists discover hidden gems in their neighborhoods or along their travels. We have some of the new Illinois Made additions on with us now. Rachel Coventry is the store manager and beekeeper at Curtis Orchard in Savoy outside of Champaign. Rachel, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
And from Woodstock, we have Annette Gast, the co-owner of the Silver Prairie Natural Soap Company, and Matt Potts, the founder of Pots and Pans Steel Band. Both of you, welcome as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
I'd like to start with you, Rachel. You're a manager and beekeeper at Curtis Orchard in Savoy, which is here in central Illinois. Just as a brief aside, I once took a career aptitude test in seventh grade and was told beekeeping was my best career choice. Unfortunately, the test did not include the question, are you afraid of bees? But I digress. We've had you on the show to talk about pumpkins before, but I'm guessing you're also known for your honey. Tell us about your honey.
That's correct. I actually recently won an award for my honey, for the world's best tasting honey. I sent it to a competition in Asheville, North Carolina, and this is an international contest, so people from all over the world submit their honey for this blind taste testing, and it goes through at least 3 to 4 rounds of judging, so it has to pass each round in order to continue on. So very proud of the honey that we produce here at the farm.
What about the farm products at your orchard? What sort of products, other things do you grow there?
We also grow apples, peaches, and pumpkins, and people can pick their own when they're out here, so that's definitely a big draw for people. They like to know, you know, how things are growing and the seasonality and the different varieties, that you can't just get a Honeycrisp in the middle of July. You might, you know, need to follow exactly what the seasons are. So I think people get to appreciate that aspect.
You know, you kind of took my next question exactly, because I'm pretty particular, right? There's certain types of apples I know I like, Fuji, other ones that I don't. I imagine everybody's different with this. So how, you know, and I'm either late or early when I go to an orchard to pick apples. How do people, you know, how should people sort of make plans to arrive at the orchard when their favorite taste is going to be coming into season?
I definitely recommend following us on Facebook, as we update that as soon as a variety becomes available. We also have a general idea on our website listed by the varieties that we grow. But, of course, it's general because it changes from year to year. I know this year things are probably going to run a little bit late because of the really cold spring that we had. So that's the best way, is just to keep up on that. But it's also, I recommend trying new varieties, and even calling or talking to us when you're here, and asking for suggestions that are similar to the flavor. Like, I highly recommend Crimson Crisp and Zestar, as they are great alternatives to Honeycrisp. And I, in fact, think they're a little bit better tasting and have more flavor.
Well, so it's interesting. You mentioned the cold spring. I was wondering about the hot summer we've been having, and, you know, not to mention tornadoes. Does the weather really play a big role in changing things from year to year?
Yes. I mean, you can lose your crop if you have hail, or if you have really, really cold temperatures, but it can also, you need the heat to warm things, you know, to ripen your apples too. You can't have it be too cold, or your apple trees won't come out of dormancy, and same with pumpkins. You know, the moisture plays a factor in whether pests and diseases are flourishing, or whether they're growing too, because you can't have it too far on either end of the spectrum. You don't want it too wet or too dry, or you're looking at adding irrigation.
Well, so I guess I'm just going to take this opportunity to ask for a personal recommendation. I'm a big fan of jazz apples, but I don't often see them at Illinois orchards. I don't know if that's a regional variety or what. What do you recommend for somebody who's like into jazz, sort of a crisp, sweet apple?
Yes, I would recommend a Crimson Crisp. Zestar is a fantastic one. Honeycrisp, of course, is Fuji, as you've said. The challenge with some of the varieties now are their club apples. So sometimes if you don't see them here, it's probably because you can't grow them, because you have to be in the club and grows
open. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Like they're patented or something like that.
Yes, exactly. Oh. Exactly.
Huh. Okay. I didn't know that. Yeah. We're speaking with some of the new additions to the Illinois Made website here on the 21st. Matt Potts is with us from Pots and Pans Steel Band in Woodstock. Matt, of all the makers on the list, yours is pretty unique, especially, I don't think you'd expect to find it in Illinois. Can you tell us about Steel Band?
Yeah, absolutely. So, for those that don't know, the steel pan is another term for the steel drum, the instrument from the Caribbean country of Trinidad and Tobago. And it starts off as a 55-gallon steel drum, and then there's a lot of work that goes into it. We are, in addition to being professional musicians, performers, we also have community groups that we run where we teach kids as young as 7 all the way up to adults. We've got our oldest adult member is about 70 right now. But then another thing that really makes us unique is I'm one of the few people in the country that can actually build and tune these instruments. So we actually have the raw 55-gallon steel drums here, and we go through a whole bunch of hammering to make them into musical instruments to put in the hands of kids and teach them how to play music on them.
How do you learn? Where do you pick up that skill? Is there a grad school for steel drum making?
There's not. There's a few different people in the country that you can study from. I spent some time studying with Cliff Alexis in DeKalb and actually put together my own major. I worked with the School of Music to create my own major that focused on this, but then I spent 6 weeks down in Trinidad just kind of floating around and absorbing as much information as I possibly could on my own. And then when I came back home, I just kind of filled in the blanks and did the best I could, and have been working on the craft ever since.
Were you there for Carnival in Trinidad? Did you get to see the big, I understand there's parades of steel bands and competition?
Oh, yes. That's a huge part of the Trinidadian culture. Unfortunately, I was down there during the summer, which they still had parades. They had one of their summer festivals is called Pan Alive and is also part of the music competition Pan the 21st Century. And I was lucky enough to play in a band of about 70 people. And we actually won the competition. And then the next day there's parades and all that sorts of stuff. So it's like a smaller version of Panorama or Carnival, which is, like you said, a huge celebration that happens around the time that we have Mardi Gras.
Well, let's hear a little bit of what this music sounds like. Matt Potts of Pots and Pans Steel Band in Woodstock. How do you think this kind of attention from the Office of Tourism will help you?
Well, we're hoping that it just kind of opens people's eyes to seeing this art form. Like you said, I mean, who expects something like this in Illinois? So we're hoping that people will be like, oh, this is a great opportunity. And we do group classes where we teach people how to play, but we're also open to teaching people how to learn how to build and tune as well, because that's an art form unto itself and needs to be continue to be spread.
Yeah. All right, we have another Illinois maker from Woodstock with us. Annetta Gast is with the Silver Prairie Natural Soap Company. Annetta, how do you make your soap?
Our soaps are all handmade in small batches. It is a traditional cold process way of making soaps. It started all the way back in the colonial days when people would take their ashes and mix it with some animal fats and water, and then stir the pot for, I don't know, quite a few hours. Today, the process has been defined a little bit. So now we use an oil blend of all the vegetable oils or butter, such as shea butter, And we mix it with either goat milk, which is our biggest product, goat milk soap, or we mix it with water or with coffee for our coffee soap. Also, we have a coconut milk and shea butter soap. So we are all formula specifics. Our biggest product is our goat milk soap. We have a goat farm called Silver Quay Farm in Harvard, which is about 15 minutes away from the store on the historical square in Woodstock. That's the milk we use for our goat milk soap from our beautiful herd of Swiss dairy goats that are pastured on organic pasture.
Wow. Is that something that's important to your product? I mean, having organic, you know, knowing that, you know, organic milk from the goats, knowing where that comes from as you're making it.
Absolutely. And I think it's something that's important to us. And it's also something that's important to our customers. There's definitely a trend that you want to know where your products are made, how they're made, exactly what ingredients are used, and how these ingredients are going to benefit you. And that's what we do. We are a local company. We are all about local, and we are all about our customers. So we know them. They come into the store. We can answer questions right there. We can even show them how to make soap, which is something we often do. The soap studio and the production area is right in the back of the store, and that's where we make all our products. And often I open the door and do soap demonstrations when people like to see me make soap and learn more about the process.
So people can watch you making this. What you mentioned other products. What else do you guys have that people might want to check out?
Well, first of all, let me go back to the soaps. So we do make our goat milk soap is our biggest product, and that's how we started out on the farm. All the products used to be made at on Silver Quay Farm before we got the store. The production got a little bit too big, and it was the time for us to move it. So besides for the goat milk soap, we have the vegan and dairy-free option of the coconut milk and shea butter soap. That is also a body soap, and that's for our vegan customers and for people that are lacto intolerant. Then we have some specialty soaps. The shampoo soap, I definitely like to highlight that. That is a very big product right now. We have produced it for more than 5 years, but right now it's really taken off. People like to switch out the commercially made products in plastic bottles, get a better product, more gentle on the hair, and not throw so much plastic bag into the environment.
Okay.
And the shampoo soap is a great option for that. It is a bar soap, a specific formula made for the hair, and it lathers up really big. It cleans your hair very quickly, rinses right out, and it will last you a very long time, easily being as economical as buying a shampoo in a bottle. And I might mention that these soaps are also really easy to travel with because it is a solid soap.
Solid soaps. You don't have to worry about liquid through the airport. I'm afraid that's our time for this segment. That was Annetta Gast from the Silver Prairie Natural Soap Company. We also heard from Matt Potts from Pots and Pans Steel Band and Rachel Coventry from Curtis Orchard. We've tweeted out info about all of them, and we'll have links to their Illinois-made sites on our website, 21stshow.org. Thank you to all of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
That's all the time we have for today. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can search for 21st Show. We have live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also find us on our Facebook page. Search for the 21st to like us or comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. If you have the NPR One app, you can also download that whenever you get your smartphone apps and find past shows there. You can set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every way to contact us, voicemail, email, social media. Do we have a fax? I don't know if we have a fax. Just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We are produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Penlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.